Americans are spending more than ever on prescription drugs. That's the big finding from a new report out this week, which looked at how much money Americans doled out for their medications in 2014.
All in all, we as a country spent $374 billion on prescription drugs last year. That's a 13% spike from 2013. So why is spending way up, and what are patients getting out of it?
Here with us to try and get to the bottom of the spending is Dr. Jeremy Green. He's a professor of medicine and the history of medicine at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Dr. Green, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me back again. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as somebody who studies medicine and pharmaceuticals, what was your reaction to these spending numbers from last year?
Well, you know, it's hard not to be disappointed on the one hand. We all want to believe that we can get high-quality health care in the United States for a cheaper price tag. And some recent trends have shown prescription spending decreasing in the United States over recent years. A lot of that have been attributed to increased use of generic drugs and price savings that were achieved there. So to witness a further increment of increase in prescription drug spending in the United States is disappointing. Although, in a sense, not surprising. It's been a large and continual cumulative growth in prescription drug spending in the United States over the last half century or more, for the most part.
Well, one thing that kind of surprised me, looking at this new information, new drugs may be a big part of this. How much does a new drug entering the market matter in terms of overall spending?
Well, I mean, I think new drugs are where you traditionally see the highest prices, and especially drugs that have emerged in the last 10 to 20 years have been more expensive, almost by orders of magnitude, than drugs that had emerged in prior decades. Many of this has been attributed to the process of development of biotech drugs. In the United States drug market, a lot of the problem is that the prices charged are really what the market will bear. We have no effective means of price control in the United States prescription drug market.
Well, and one case made for generic drugs is that they make drugs cheaper overall, but a case made against them in some cases, or against the way the patenting process works, is drug companies in that window they have before generic alternatives are allowed, they want to make as much money as they can. Is that part of the factor in the high cost of newer drugs?
It's definitely part of the factor, and there's a lot of numbers that gets tossed around here. Most commonly, we see the round figure of $1 billion as the average cost for the R&D from initiation to market for any successful new drug launched in the United States. And, of course, there's a lot of outlay for R&D that's required to develop a new drug. If we want to believe that we should support the development of more innovative pharmaceutical products, then we have to be prepared to see some means for innovative companies to recoup those investments. And so that's really the logic behind much of pharmaceutical regulation, or at least policy surrounding drug access in the United States, where we balance that patent-protected period where an innovative drug company can recoup the costs of innovation using high prices and a patent-protected monopoly with what we expect to be a reduction of prices once a drug goes off patent and it's available for generic competition. And so we almost make, we naturalize two different stages in the life cycle of a drug. The first, this patent-protected period when the drug is expected to have very high prices, and the second, a generic competition period where we expect drug prices to go down. And really that's how we balance innovation access in the United States, kind of chronologically.
And a big story in medication last year that, I'll be honest, went completely under my radar, the release of new drugs for the disease hepatitis C. Can you talk about that?
Oh, this is both a triumph and tragedy story. On the one hand, we have seen the development of new drugs that are actually curative and easily administered for the treatment of hepatitis C, which prior to these new medications has been a disease with profound chronic complications. The only treatment options for it were very, took quite a long term, were difficult to administer. So this is really, in some ways, a fruit of what we want to see from the innovative pharmaceutical sector. Yet the drugs were priced so high that many state Medicaid programs realized that if they were to allow access to the drugs to all patients that needed them, the state Medicaid programs would simply go bankrupt. And so it became a test case both in demonstrating how the innovative pharmaceutical industry was still capable of producing truly innovative new drugs with dramatic public health potential. And yet the increase in price on these agents over the last few decades has come to the point where this is not simply a question of can something like a new antiretroviral drug for the treatment of HIV/AIDS be accessible in countries in the global north but not in affordable in countries in sub-Saharan Africa. These are questions of new drugs not being available to populations who need them in the United States.
Will they get, even before they hit that generic stage, do they tend to get new drugs, I should say, tend to get cheaper over time?
So pharmacoeconomics is a really difficult field to study. And I want to say at the outset, I'm a clinician, I'm an internist, I'm a historian, but I'm not an economist. And one of the reasons that pharmacoeconomics is so hard to study is it's really difficult for people like me to perceive the true cost of drugs. When pharmacies pay for drugs and insurers pay for drugs, they engage in contracts, bundling contracts, discount contracts with drug companies, often mediated through third parties called pharmacy benefit managers. So it becomes very difficult to understand what the true cost of drugs actually are to any individual entity in the healthcare system. We just see the total price tag at the end in reports like the ones published this week.
Talking to Dr. Jeremy Green, looking at a new report that came out, said we spent a lot of money on pharmaceutical medications last year, 13% increase over 2013, in fact, looking into some of the reasons and consequences for that. Now, one thing, Dr. Green, people are watching is the Affordable Care Act. More people maybe have access to health care, therefore more people have access to medications. Therefore, more money is going into prescription medications. How big a part of the story was that, do you think?
Well, I can't comment right now on the ACA's impact and this particular report. Safe to say that, of course, both sides, in such a polarized environment, one can immediately see how both sides will point the finger at either the ACA being a positive dimension in this report or the ACA being a negative dimension in this report. And I think this is one of the casualties we see of healthcare policy in the 21st century in the United States, that evidence immediately gets appropriated to one or another side of a preformed argument.
Now, you recently were quoted by NPR talking about another angle on this story, a drug that's been with us a long time. You'd think it would be generic and cheap by now, insulin. But you write it's very hard for people always to find inexpensive insulin. Can you tell us that story?
Well, I think the insulin story, in a nutshell, demonstrates several of the problems of increasing price tag of prescription drugs in the United States. Insulin was discovered in 1921. It was first patented in 1923. It's a drug that affects, it's a drug necessary for the treatment of diabetes in about 6 million persons living with insulin-dependent diabetes in this country. And yet there is no generic version of insulin available in the United States as of the year 2015. And to understand why that's true and that a person living without insurance coming to meet to my clinic in East Baltimore, for example, would be told at most pharmacies that they'd have to pay $120 to $300 or $400 for a vial, a single monthly vial of insulin, helps us begin to grapple with some of the problems of basic essential medicines remaining out of reach or creating increasing price tags in North America. Now, part of what happened in the insulin story is that insulin has not been one drug continuously from 1921 to the present. If you look in the 30s and 40s, new ways of producing insulin that can last longer in the body were produced. In the 50s and 60s, we see other innovations. But by the late 1970s, the newly developed biotech industry comes up with recombinant human insulin produced by bacteria using recombinant DNA technology. And each of these innovations makes insulin a little bit more effective, a little bit safer, and yet it also helps to keep insulin products that are currently being used on patent and quite expensive. And oddly enough, the older products, which did work, right, animal insulins, pork and beef insulins worked for millions of diabetic patients, are now no longer produced for sale in the United States of America. So the only options available for people living with diabetes are actually quite expensive, even for this old drug.
And what are the consequences? I want to talk about the consequences for the patients you're talking about who can't afford the insulin that's generally available to them in an area.
Well, And I should clarify that the consequences are quite different for people living with what's called type 1 diabetes, juvenile onset diabetes, in which the pancreas does not produce insulin, and people living with type 2 diabetes or adult onset diabetes, with whom insulin can be necessary to control blood sugar and prevent long-term complications like stroke, gangrene, kidney failure. And one of the things you see is in the week since my colleague Kevin Riggs and I published this article, we received a lot of correspondence from people living with diabetes who have had to pursue different strategies to deal with the high cost of insulin. Many people with type 1 diabetes who don't have insurance find that they need to live their lives around places like Walmart. It turns out Walmart offers $25 a vial insulin that they're able to contract using their huge buying power and a special relationship they formed with the makers of Novalin. They offer a brand called Relyon, which is their house brand of cheap insulin. It's quite interesting that although U.S. pharmaceutical policy does not provide for cheap, affordable insulin for people living with diabetes, the company Walmart has, and so many people living with type 1 diabetes have focused some of their housing moves to be close to Walmart's so that they can know they'll have access to insulin. It's a lifeline. It works for them, but it's a thin one because it's a marketing policy of Walmart, and they could discontinue it at any time. Many people living with type 2 diabetes, many people I see in my clinic, go for a month or two or longer without their insulin and lose control of their diabetes. Their blood sugars go up through the roof, and they have poorly controlled diabetes and face very real bodily consequences of that. We then pay collectively a lot more money for hospital care of treating potentially preventable complications of diabetes.
We're talking right now with Dr. Jeremy Green about prescription drug spending in the United States. According to a new report, Americans spent more than ever on drugs last year. It's a big jump from where we were at in 2013. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
If you're taking prescription drugs, have you been spending more on them lately? And why do you think that is? And if you work in the medical community or for an insurance company, what do you make about all of this? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Dr. Jeremy Green about prescription drug spending in the U.S. We set a spending record, apparently, in 2014, according to a new report. We're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself spending more on prescription these days? Or someone in your family, are you concerned with what you're paying? If you're in the medical field, what do you think about this news? What do you see going on in your practice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Casey on the line in Bayfield. Casey, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, what do you think?
My question is, your guest said he's not an economist. I'm currently in college for economics right now, and in one of my classes, they talked specifically about insulin, so that was really interesting to me that he brought it up. Insulin, from what I got from the lecture, is kind of a special area of economics because there's not really a viable alternative for it. Does the guest have... Does he see this often, that there's no alternative and that could potentially be driving up the cost of health care?
Interesting, Casey. Thanks for bringing that up. Dr. Green, are there a lot of medications where it's this one or nothing else?
Oh, there are plenty of medications where it's this one or nothing else, but I guess a lot depends on what we call the category of this one, right? Mm-hmm. So this is often important when there's a patent-based monopoly, and I think that's the way that the current insulin market works in the United States, is that the existing insulins have been protected by patents. A lot of the conversation about insulin right now focuses on the fact that current insulins that are on the U.S. market are products of biotech, and biotech drugs are more expensive. It's also harder to figure out how to regulate generic copies of biotech drugs, partly because we haven't developed an effective regulatory pathway. It's really just under construction right now. It's not quite the same as older drugs where it's a chemical where you know where every atom is. So a lot of conversations about why there's no generic insulin focused about the fact that no biosimilar drugs have been approved for market yet. And yet, as a historian, I guess my answer here to Casey is that there actually are many alternatives to insulin that aren't considered, which is to say one alternative not being considered to present-day biotech insulins are the older animal insulins that used to be produced and sold effectively on the American market for quite cheap prices and worked for many, many people living with diabetes. Now, the newer insulins, the biotech recombinant DNA human insulins, the synthetic analogs, are better. They're slightly better, but they are certainly, you know, the older insulins are certainly better than no insulin at all. So as a historian, I think it's important to take a longer perspective on things and realize there are actually alternatives to the insulin market today that we're not seeing. And those alternatives are the products that used to be here 2 and 3 decades ago that we now have no access to.
Thanks for the call, Casey. We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Abby on the line in Appleton. Abby, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm calling. I have a 14-year-old son that has very severe Crohn's disease, and he needs a monthly infusion of Remicade, which is in the neighborhood of $20,000 every month. Now, that is considered a prescription drug, not a hospital treatment, even though he needs to be hospitalized for it. So we actually just moved from the Madison area because our insurance told us that American Family Hospital charges nearly twice what Children's Hospital in Nina does. So they are willing to cover more of it there. But I mean, at any rate, at this point, we are going to be filing bankruptcy so my son can get the medication he needs.
Wow. Abby, you said $20,000 a month?
Correct.
Abby, thank you. Good luck to you and your family dealing with that. Wow, there's a lot there, Dr. Green. Let's start with this a huge variation, the amount one hospital versus another hospital or provider might charge for the same medication. Is that a common story?
It is a very common story, unfortunately. And Abby, first of all, let me say thanks for sharing your story. And I'm very sorry to hear that you and your family are filing personal bankruptcy for health-related expenses. And unfortunately, you are one of many, many American households that are forced into this situation because of the rising costs of health care. And again, what you're discussing is not a boutique form of health care, but really an essential medicine for the management of your son's illness, Crohn's disease, which is a very common chronic disease in the United States. To get at this problem of variation, there's a group in Dartmouth that began to publish a Dartmouth Health Atlas, which looked at geographical variations of health expenditures. And there are extraordinary differences in the costs of procedures between different regions of the country and between different towns and cities within the same region. And again, you're describing your own personal migration of how American families are choosing where they live now, are being forced to relocate based on differential health expenditures. And I think it's a real shame as to where our biomedical system has come to, that our ability to guarantee basic standards of health care for our citizens has been so compromised.
Abby, thanks for calling. And again, good luck to you. We're talking to Dr. Jeremy Green about the cost of medications, prescription medications, here in the United States. Jason is with us next in Menominee. Jason, hi.
Hey. Hey, thanks for having me on. So I guess my question is, how would this be a regulatory type of a deal? I'm not a big fan of government regulation of private enterprise, so I'm wondering if there's a way kind of, I guess, to sidestep this. If, like, Canada, Mexico, India, whatever, pays $1 a pill and we pay $10 a pill or something like that, would there be a way of, like, just saying we're not paying any more than the lowest payer out there, you know, we as in the United States people, and, you know, not to say that we should only pay a dollar bill because I'm, you know, all for R&D and stuff like that, but, you know, just to make them kind of bump the prices up a little bit to these other customers. And
gotcha. Jason, I want to jump in because we're a little short on time. Dr. Green, first, is that Jason's premise right? Do we generally pay more for the same drug here in the U.S. versus other developed countries?
Oh, without a doubt, he's right on there.
All right, and then he's asking, I guess, if there are ways to even that out, either by making other countries pay more or by negotiating and saying, why are we paying so much more than those other countries? A huge question. A lot of people have been tackling this. Do you have thoughts on that, though?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, and I've approached it as a historian, looking at the singularity of the American drug market, why we pay so much, why we have so many prescriptions per capita on the one hand, but why we pay so much more for those prescriptions as well. It's fascinating to me, Jason, your suggestion here that what we should do is make other countries pay more for the price of innovation. And certainly this is something that pharmaceutical manufacturers in the United States have been arguing for years, that prescription drug prices need to be high in America because we are the place where we are the market that sustains innovation. At the same time, the reason those drug prices are lower in places like Canada and the UK is because these are countries who have actually used their national health systems to negotiate lower prices of drugs. Something we have consistently refused to do in discussions of pharmaceutical policy in the United States. When Medicare Part D went through expanding dramatically the federal government's involvement in paying for prescription drug use in the United States, riders were put on the bill expressly prohibiting the use of the power of the purse to negotiate lower prices. So we've done everything we can in national policy to not negotiate lower prices in the U.S. So it seems kind of ironic to then try and chastise other countries that have.
So, Dr. Green, briefly, as we wrap up, we had the Affordable Care Act debate. Is anybody trying to change things? Do you see policy moves, industry moves, anybody trying to bring these prices down for the newer drugs that we've been focusing on?
Well, I mean, I think original sin comes as no surprise. On the one hand, it's not surprising that if we have an arena in which pharmaceutical companies are allowed to set whatever price they want for a drug, they will set high prices. And until we try and do things to create leverage points and buyer points where prices can, where lower prices and more reasonable prices can be incented, I think the system will work as it's built to work, as it's intended to work. What I am concerned about, what I'm following closely in Congress right now, are unexpected price hikes that have been happening in the generic drug domain. A review of CMS data recently found that 10% of generic drugs doubled in price in the recent year, and that half of all generic drugs increased in cost from 2013 to 2014. So this arena in which we expect to see price savings, the generic drug arena, is now showing unexpected price hikes and drug shortages.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Green, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Jeremy Green, a professor of medicine and history of medicine at Johns Hopkins University.